Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 518, titled Islamism in Europe. This is being recorded on July 17th of the year 2005. Before we get into the main body of the material in this broadcast, I want to note for people that there's a great deal of information available on the web, both audio files and printed information. I'm going to run down some of that at the end of this side. I simply want to note for veteran listeners that a listener, a very diligent and heroic listener in my opinion, has put together blogs of both the For the Record descriptions and the RFA archive shows. So for listeners slash readers who find the written descriptions that I have put together over the years to be somewhat difficult in terms of format, and there have been some people who've registered such complaints, do be aware that now, thanks to this listener, the For the Record shows are up to date as a blog. The For the Record descriptions are up to date as a blog. So that and the RFA blog are available, will be available, not only on the Spitfire website, but at the top of every written description, there will be links to both of those blogs. Between that and WFMU's podcasting, the For the Record shows, this effort is getting somewhat up to date, technologically speaking. So do be aware of that. More about that at the end of the side. Now, in the last week and a half, there has been a great deal of attention focused on Islamism in Europe. In particular, there have been a lot of questions asked and a fair amount of soul-searching, individual and institutional, following the bombings of transit routes in London, bus and subway routes. And one of the things that we have spoken about at considerable length over the years has been the activism of the Muslim Brotherhood. That is an Islamic fascist organization that was aligned with the Nazis in fascist Italy in World War II. It has given rise to many of the Islamist terrorist groups of this time, including Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. It also, at least its political wing, officially at least, mouths a more moderate line, but there's a sharp declension between the military and the political wings of this organization, so it's sort of Janus-faced. And behind the nice liberal-sounding rhetoric of the political and the political branch of the Brotherhood lies an altogether intractable and ultimately, in its manifestations, murderous manifestation of the military wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. The United Kingdom is among those places where Islamism, or Islamofascism, as I often call it, has taken root. One of the things that we've looked at in connection with the book Dollars for Terror, and in connection with some of the discussion of the Ramadan brothers, Tariq and Hamdi Ramadan, the sons of Saeed Ramadan, about whom we're going to say more in a minute, one of the things that they note is that the way to bring radical Islam to Europe and to have it conquer the West is to pay lip service to liberal democratic values in the West and then to use those democratic values in order to assure the triumph of totalitarian Islam. As always, I want to stress very strongly that when I'm talking about Islamism or Islamofascism or totalitarian Islam, I am not in any way impugning Islam as a religion. However, I am talking about a politicized and fascistic and totalitarian-minded element within that religion. So simply take note of that. In the last part of For the Record program 513, we took a look at an article called The Muslim Brotherhood's Conquest of Europe, and it talked about, in particular, how Germany had become an epicenter for the spread of radical Islam around the world. Again, in the wake of the bombings in London, it has become the relatively tolerant attitude of the British towards some radical Islamist preachers has come into sharp relief, and the whole discussion of radical Islam in Europe is one that cannot be adequately dealt with without dealing with the Muslim Brotherhood. And as listeners to this broadcast know, that organization has a fascist heritage, as we've spoken about in so many different programs. This past week, the Wall Street Journal featured a series on Islam in Europe, and this past Tuesday, July 12th, the lead story in the Wall Street Journal a long story covering much of the front page, an entire page and a half or so on the inside of the paper, deals not only with the Muslim Brotherhood in Europe, but specifically its role in helping to initiate the construction of the Islamic Center of Munich, a mosque in Munich that reflects the fascist heritage of much of the Islamist movement. Much of this broadcast is going to be a reading of this article in its entirety, because it's very seldom that one sees an article of this magnitude and importance in the mainstream press. I want to stress that there are a number of things missing in this story. For example, at no point does the writer mention that the Muslim Brotherhood itself was aligned with Nazi Germany. There's no discussion in here, for example, of Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, SS major and a pivotal figure in the Islamic and Arabic worlds, and one of the founts for the infiltration of fascism into the Islamic community in the 20th century. Those deficiencies notwithstanding, again, no discussion of the Brotherhood's association with the Third Reich, no mention of Haji Amin al-Husseini, those deficiencies notwithstanding. For example, when they talk about the Bank al-Taqwa, there's no mention that Yousef Nada was apparently an Abwehr agent, a Third Reich intelligence agent in World War II, and according to the Asia Times, helped the Grand Mufti to escape from Germany to Palestine at the end of World War II. Nonetheless, this article is a very good one and a very important one. It does stress the continuity from the Third Reich to contemporary radical Islam. It also discusses the profound links between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Central Intelligence Agency. It discusses the continuity of these fascist Muslim sponsors from Nazi Germany to the post-war Federal Republic of Germany. It also, as we go through the article, it's also going to become quite apparent that even though during the Cold War, and to a lesser extent still, German and U.S. intelligence cooperate, it also highlights the strong rivalries between German and U.S. intelligence. Those rivalries have deepened in the wake of the Cold War, and there are elements of German intelligence that are actively working with what I call the Underground Reich. There are other elements that are working for democracy with a small d and are actively working against the Islamists, but as is the case in the United States, there appears to be a fifth column within German intelligence that is actively aiding those they are ostensibly working against. So, with those caveats and with that advisory, we are now going to read this article in its entirety. This is from the front page. We're going to continue with the inside pages. From the front page of the Wall Street Journal from Tuesday, July 12th of 2005. By the way, vis-a-vis the Wall Street Journal, this is an important newspaper to read. There's a lot of very good reportage. The op-ed page and the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal should, in my opinion, be declared a Superfund site. They are highly toxic and can prove extremely damaging to human life, but a lot of the reporting is quite good, and the following story is representative of that. And see how many mainstream media voices are going to touch this. Again, front page, Wall Street Journal, Tuesday, July 12, 2005, a blockbuster article by Ian Johnson. This is datelined Munich, Germany, and headlined, How a Mosque for Ex-Nazis Became Center of Radical Islam, subheaded, Documents Reveal Triumph by Muslim Brotherhood in Post-War Munich, and another subhead, A CIA Plan to Fight Soviets. The article reads as follows. North of this prosperous city of engineers and automakers is an elegant mosque with a slender minaret and a turquoise dome. A stand of pines shields it from a busy street. In a country of more than 3 million Muslims, it looks unremarkable, another place of prayer for Europe's fastest growing religion. The mosque's history, however, tells a more tumultuous story. Buried in government and private archives are hundreds of documents that trace the battle to control the Islamic Center of Munich. Never before made public, the material shows how radical Islam established one of its first and most important beachheads in the West when a group of ex-Nazi soldiers decided to build a mosque. The soldiers' presence in Munich was part of a nearly forgotten subplot to World War II. the decision by tens of thousands of Muslims in the Soviet Red Army to switch sides and fight for Hitler. By the way, parenthetically, there were also Muslims in some of the colonial territories held by the British and French, and also Muslims in the Balkans who made a similar decision. And again, what is not mentioned in this article is the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood was allied with the fascist powers of Europe. And, as is the case with many of these anti-Soviet and former Nazi Muslims, many of them jumped to various Western intelligences at the end of World War II. Continuing with this story. The soldiers' presence in Munich was part of a nearly forgotten subplot to World War II. The decision by tens of thousands of Muslims in the Soviet Red Army to switch sides and fight for Hitler. After the war, thousands sought refuge in West Germany, building one of the largest Muslim communities in 1950s Europe. When the Cold War heated up, they were a coveted prize for their language skills and contacts back in the Soviet Union. For more than a decade, U.S., West German, Soviet, and British intelligence agencies vied for control of them in the new battle of democracy versus communism. Yet the victor wasn't any of these Cold War combatants. Instead, it was a movement with an equally powerful ideology, the Muslim Brotherhood. Founded in 1920s Egypt as a social reform movement, the Brotherhood became the fountainhead of political Islam, which calls for the Muslim religion to dominate all aspects of life. A powerful force for political change throughout the Muslim world, the Brotherhood also inspired some of the deadliest terrorist movements of the past quarter century, including Hamas and Al-Qaeda. The story of how the Brotherhood exported its creed to the heart of Europe highlights a recurring error by Western democracies. For decades, countries have tried to cut deals with political Islam, backing it in order to defeat another enemy, especially communism. Most famously, the U.S. and its allies built up Mujahideen holy warriors in 1980s Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Union, paving the way for the rise of Osama bin Laden, who quickly turned on his allies in the 1990s. Munich was a momentous early example of this dubious strategy. Documents and interviews show how the Muslim Brotherhood formed a working arrangement with U.S. intelligence organizations, outmaneuvering German agencies for control of the former Nazi soldiers and their mosque. But the U.S. lost its hold on the movement, and in short order, conservative, arch-Catholic Bavaria had become host to a center of radical Islam. If you want to understand the structure of political Islam, you have to look at what happened in Munich, says Stefan Meining, a Munich-based historian who was studying the Islamic Center. Quote, Munich is the origin of a network that now reaches around the world. Unquote. Political and social groups affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood now dominate organized Islamic life across a broad swath of Western Europe. These connections are frequently little known, even by the intelligence services and police agencies of these countries. While these groups renounce terrorism and officially advocate assimilation, the upshot of their message is that Europe's Muslims, now representing between 5 and 10% of the continent's population, need to be walled off from Western culture. This, in turn, has helped create fertile ground for violent ideas. Islamic terrorists have increasingly used Europe as a launching pad for their attacks, from the September 11th assault on the U.S. to last year's bombing of trains in Madrid. These current tensions are embedded in the events of half a century ago. Post-war Munich was a ruined city packed with Muslim emigres fleeing persecution. While the West tried to observe and control them as valuable pawns in the Cold War, they encountered formidable rivals seeking their own power bases in Europe's burgeoning Muslim world. Over the next few decades, four men would try successively to control the Munich mosque. A brilliant professor of Turkic studies, an imam in Hitler's SS, a charismatic Muslim writer with a worldwide following, and a hard-nosed Muslim financier now under investigation for backing terrorism. Most favored some sort of accommodation with the West, but the victor had a bolder vision, a global Islam opposed to the ideals of secular democracy. Now, the first of these people, the brilliant professor of Turkic studies, is a guy named Gerhard von Mende. As we're going to see, he was a Baltic German who then worked for the Third Reich's Ostministerium with these various Turkic and Islamic Muslims Turkic Muslims and some of their Islamic associates. He then functioned in post-war Germany with these same elements. And later we're going to see how he hooks up with some of these other people as well, including Saeed Ramadan, and later Ali Galeb Himat of Bank al-Taqwa. Gerhard von Mende's interest in Muslims originated in 1919 when his father was murdered. The family had lived in Riga, part of a once large German minority in Latvia. When the tiny land was invaded by the Red Army at the end of World War I, members of the bourgeoisie were rounded up and sent on a forced march. Mr. von Mende's father, a banker, was pulled out of the line and shot dead. That awakened in the 14-year-old a loathing of things Russian. After fleeing with his mother and six siblings to Germany, he chose to study other people who were opposed but who were oppressed by Russian rule, the Muslims of Central Asia. A blizzard of papers and books brought him academic prominence. Linguistically gifted, he spoke fluent Russian, Latvian, and French, as well as passable Turkish and Arabic. When he married a Norwegian, he picked up her native tongue as well. The Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941 put a premium on people like Mr. von Mende, who understood something about the lands that Germany's blitzkrieg was overrunning. He kept his job at Berlin University, but was seconded to the new Imperial Ministry for Occupied Eastern Territories, or Ostministerium, to head a department overseeing the Caucasus. Germany's initial victories left it with a staggering number of Soviet prisoners, 5 million in all. Due in part to the efforts of Mr. von Mende and the Ostministerium, Hitler agreed to free prisoners who would take up arms against the Soviets. The Nazis set up Ostalgionen, Eastern Legions, made up primarily of non-Russian minorities eager to pay Moscow back for decades of oppression. Up to 1 million soldiers took up Hitler's offer, parenthetically marching behind the banner of the Grand Mufti. And as we've seen in so many programs after the war, much of the stewardship of elements like this, the most radical of them, was handled by François Genoux, a name that is not mentioned anywhere in this article. Continuing. As the war progressed, Mr. von Mende became one of the chief architects of the Nazi policy toward Soviet minorities. He was dubbed their Lord Protector, establishing national committees of Tatars, Turks, Georgians, Azerbaijanis, and Armenians. Desperate for soldiers, the Nazis viewed these committees as little more than a way to keep their turncoat allies in the war. But for the people involved, they were like governments in exile, a taste of independence for which they were grateful to Mr. von Mende. Colleagues from this era describe Mr. von Mende as a well-dressed, regal man with a wry smile who used his personal charm to win over the exiles, especially his favorites, the Turkic Muslims of Central Asia. He opened his home in Berlin to them for long dinners with the conversation flowing in Russian, Turkish, and German. In the last months of the war, he cemented their loyalty through an act of bureaucratic genius. With Germany's infrastructure bombed to a pulp, he managed to get thousands of, quote, his, unquote, Turks transferred to the Western Front, Greece, Italy, Denmark, and Belgium, figuring it would be better if they ended up in British or American prisoner of war camps than Soviet. Those who fell into Soviet hands were shot as traitors. By the late 1940s, hundreds of Muslim ex-soldiers were stranded in the U.S. zone of occupation in Munich. Mr. von Mende, whose Nazi past left him with limited job prospects, decided to devote himself to looking out for them. That decision would prove beneficial both for the Muslims and for Mr. von Mende. It was the beginning of the Cold War, and Western intelligence agencies were desperate for anyone who could provide a glimpse behind the Iron Curtain. They needed people to analyze documents, broadcast anti-Soviet propaganda, and recruit spies. In October of 1945, Mr. von Mende wrote a letter to a Major Morrison, unquote, in the British Army, according to a letter in his private papers that his family made available. He laid out the Ostministerium's unique source of knowledge about the Soviet peoples. He explained who worked for it and in which POW or displaced persons camp they were being held. It was the beginning of his intelligence career. Mr. von Mende settled in the British-occupied sector of Germany in the commercial center of Dusseldorf. Although he was no longer an academic, he called his office the Eastern European Research Service, unquote. His staff was made up of ex-Ostministerium employees who'd worked for the Third Reich, basically a recreation of the Nazi apparatus that oversaw the Muslims during the war. Funding came from British occupation forces initially, then a variety of West German agencies, including the National Domestic Intelligence Agency and the German Foreign Ministry, according to Foreign Ministry documents and Mr. von Mendes' private correspondence. Mr. von Mendes spent enormous amounts of time helping the Muslims who used to work for him in the Ostministerium. He wrung money out of the West German bureaucracy for them to be fed, clothed, and housed. Conditions were appalling, and even a decade after the war's end, many were still living in barracks. But at heart, his task was simple: keep tabs on the emigre and prevent them from falling into another country's control. The main threat was the Soviet Union, who wanted to stop the emigre from making anti-communist propaganda. Some emigre leaders in West Germany were murdered. Many carried weapons in defense against KGB assassins. By 1956, a rival emerged to threaten Mr. von Mendes' control over the Muslim ex-soldiers of Munich: the American Committee for Liberation from Bolshevism, widely known as AMCOM-LIB. Set up as a U.S. non-governmental organization to run Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, AMCOM-LIB was in fact a thinly disguised front for the Central Intelligence Agency. CIA funding lasted until 1971, when Congress cut AMCOM-LIB's ties to the intelligence agency. During the 1950s, the head of AMCOM-LIB's political organization was Isaac Patch, who was now 95 and living in retirement in New Hampshire. Reached by telephone, Mr. Patch defended AMCOM-LIB's strategy of using Muslims to fight the Soviets. Quote, "Islam was an important factor, no question about it," Mr. Patch said, again quoting, "They were strong believers and strong anti-communists," unquote. AMCOM-LIB forged ties with Ibrahim Gacoglu, G-A-C-A-O-G-L-U, a former Nazi soldier from the Caucasus who, like Mr. von Mende, was looking after Muslim soldiers stranded in Germany. Mr. Gacoglu controlled food packages from the U.S., which he doled out to his followers according to his organization's documents. Mr. Gacoglu also did propaganda work for Radio Free Europe. In 1957, for example, he held a news conference with another former German political officer, Garip Sultan, who headed Radio Liberty's Tatar service, according to documents and Mr. Sultan. The two decried Stalin's abuses in Chechnya. Mr. Sultan, now 81 years old, said in an interview that he wrote Mr. Gacoglu's speeches and a pamphlet for him on the situation of Muslims. For Mr. von Mende and his colleagues, Mr. Gacoglu's CIA connections were a problem. West Germany and the U.S. were on the same side of the Cold War, but Mr. von Mende didn't appreciate foreign agencies trying to influence German residents. As one informant had put it in a report to his boss, quote, "Germany is a gate that no one controls because there doesn't seem to be a gatekeeper. Everyone comes and does what he pleases," unquote. Mr. von Mende decided that Germany's Muslims needed a leader he could trust. He turned to a friend from the war, Nuruddin Nabikodshah Namangani. N-A-M-A-N-G-A-N-I is the man's last name. Mr. Namangani comes from a long line of imams in his native land, modern-day Uzbekistan. But his religious service had mostly been in an unholy organization, Hitler's infamous SS. According to his autobiographical sketch he gave German authorities, he had been arrested by Stalin's security forces in 1941 and soon after liberated by the invading German army. He served as imam in various capacities, ending as imam for an SS division. He won some of Germany's highest recommendations, including the Iron Cross. Mr. Namangani arrived in Munich in 1956 to an uproar. Opponents such as Mr. Gacoglu charged Mr. Namangani with having participated in wartime atrocities. Mr. Namangani's unit reportedly helped put down the 1944 Warsaw uprising of Polish partisans against the Nazis, but any personal role in atrocities is not evident in German war records. Mr. von Mende beat back the attacks, persuading the federal government in Bonn to accept Mr. Namangani as the Hauptimam, or chief imam, of Germany's Muslims on the West German payroll. In late 1958, Mr. Namangani came up with a plan to rally the ex-Muslim soldiers behind him, a mosque construction commission, unquote. At the time, Germany had only a couple of mosques. Munich's mosque would be different, bigger and dedicated not to traders and visitors, but to Germany's first permanent Muslim population of any note. Quote, For 13 years, Muslims haven't had a fixed place for their services and have had to hold them in various places, unquote, Mr. Namangadi told the assembled 50 or so Muslims, including some Muslim students from the Middle East. Once, Muslims had been forced to hold services even in a brewery, other times in a museum, according to minutes of the mosque commission. Now, he told the group, Munich would be a center for Muslims, and the Bavarian state government would certainly help out, according to the minutes. It was a big event, so big, in fact, that someone special was on hand, Saeed Ramadan, the Geneva-based Secretary General of the World Islamic Congress, a group that wanted to unite Muslims around the world. The rest of those assembled donated 125 marks in total, about $275 in today's money, for the mosque's construction. Mr. Ramadan himself gave 1,000 marks. Mr. von Mende quickly put out feelers for information on the well-heeled visitors. Soon, his index of people to watch contained a new entry. Quote, Saeed Ramadan, Geneva, circa 36 years old, 3 children. Since 1956, drives an expensive Cadillac, gift of the Saudi Arabian government. R.S. is supposed to be a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Unquote. As we're going to see, not only was Saeed Ramadan a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, he was its de facto head at this time. He was the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, the organization's founder, and specifically one of the reasons he went to Munich was to, according to the book Dollars for Terror that we've examined in the past, was to rekindle the alignment between the residual forces of Nazism and radical Islam. There is no discussion in this article, again, of the Muslim Brotherhood's alignment with Nazi Germany. Nonetheless, though, I think this is a very important article, and some of the continuity between the radical Islam that was nurtured by the Third Reich to some of these SS imams, to the German intelligence services, to the CIA, all of this in the context of the Cold War, all of those, I think, make this a very, very important article indeed, and we're going to continue with this on the second side of the program. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, there is a great deal of information available online, a growing body of information at that. First of all, sister station WFMU has been archiving the For the Record programs. The entire series is available on Real Audio, much of it in MP3 as well. More recent programs, the last roughly 4 to 5 years, are available at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emory, one word, DAVEEMORY. Older shows are available at a longer URL, linked to that address and to the Spitfire website, about which I'm going to say more in a minute. Be aware that WFMU is now podcasting the For the Record shows, so if you would like to get podcast versions of For the Record, there is a website, there is a place to click on WFMU's website, also at the top of each For the Record description, in order to access the podcasting page for WFMU, if you would like to get For the Record a podcast to you. Also, again, be aware of the Spitfire website. Spitfire is the CD duplication service that distributes all of the various programs and lectures that I've done over the years. By the way, I do not get any money whatsoever from the Spitfire arrangement. It is a labor of love and duty. The Spitfire website has tons of information available in print. First of all, the For the Record section contains long article-length descriptions of each For the Record program, their descriptions of various lectures, and some of the archive shows that are available. There's also a search function on the Spitfire website if you would like to search the indexed archives for the Record and other shows. There is a search function on the Spitfire website. Also, there is a page to click on for those of you who would like to support the work that I'm doing, and for those of you who have, an earnest, hearty thank you from yours truly. So again, www.spitfirelist.com, tons of information there and links to the WFMU websites as well. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 518, Islamism in Europe, being recorded on July 17th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.